Do, 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 do. Right, so I need to find Wikipedia. And this is Explorer. and it's found that River Phoenix film, which is not what I want. I want Deep Space Nine. Deep Space Nine. Deep Space Nine. This is our song, Deep Space Nine. I've made up words to Deep Space Nine. Come with us now on Deep Space Nine.
We all know what's opening the episode now.
Come on, those lyrics were genius.
That was brilliant.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Red alert! All crew members report to battle stations.
Red alert. Shields up.
What shields?
You Starfleet officers! Now start acting like it!
Oh, it's just Garrick. Plain, simple, Garrick.
Dax, we might have just discovered the first stable wormhole known to exist.
The wormhole does bring them our way, doesn't it?
Everyone wants a piece of the new frontier.
This will surely become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. But for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
Quite a motley crew you've assembled here, Benji.
Listen to The Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast. And here are your hosts, Andrew Leyland and Paul Spataro.
Bloody hell. Oh, I love a woman in uniform.
Hello, everybody. Hope you enjoyed that musical introduction. Welcome to Listen to the Prophets of Deep Space Nine podcast, a Two True Freaks presentation. I am Andrew Leyland. I will be your singer tonight. Sit down, pull up a pew. It's a shame we've not introduced that guy from Time Tunnel who later does do the singing in Deep Space Nine. I am joined, as ever, by Dr. Bill Robinson.
Oh, wait, this isn't Deep Space Nine Has Talent?
And you two are my judge. And Mr.
Well,
Paul Spataro.
We're going to decide whether or not you can go on and work at Quark's Bar.
I don't think I have the assets for Quark's Bar.
And have you watched, Bill, have you watched Celebrity Apprentice at all in the new season? Because Arnold is hosting it.
No, but I've heard that Arnold dropped some one-liners, apparently.
Yeah, I heard it when they eliminate somebody. It's you've been fired. Hasta la vista, baby.
He doesn't say you're terminated.
But this isn't a Celebrity Apprentice podcast.
Stop us before we tangent again.
Okay. Do we have any Star Trek news?
No.
That would be a massive no. And we do emails at the end, and we're also doing our discussion of A Stitch in Time, the Andrew J. Robinson novel.
We would do emails at the end if we had any email.
We'll have what Blaine thought of this one. That counts as an email, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And we've moved our segment about A Stitch in Time, the Andrew J. Robinson novel, to the end of the show, so that if you do not want to be spoiled for future events that are mentioned in the book, then you can skip the end of the show. So as it stands then, we may as well just go straight into Explorers, which is the 22nd episode of the third season of Deep Space Nine and the 68th episode of the series overall.
Sisko embarks on a mythical voyage.
According to legend, the ancient Bajorans used ships like these to explore their star system.
Of danger.
I'm not sure this design is spaceworthy.
And discovery.
We'll make a sailor out of you yet.
But will his journey into the unknown...
Where did we end up?
Could be light years off course.
...lead him into disaster on the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Directed by Cliff Bowl, the teleplay was by Arene Echevarria, with a story by Hilary J. Barda. Originally aired on May 8th, 1995. Benjamin Sisko, sporting a fresh goatee, has been studying the ancient Bajoran culture and determines that the old legend holds a grain of truth. Ancient Bajorans may have travelled outside their own solar system using solar winds to power small sublight craft. Sisko has obtained diagrams of the construction of the lightship, and his son, Jake Sisko, agrees to accompany him as he retraces the original route of the ancient Bajorans in the hopes of validating an even older theory that these solar vessels not only made it out of the solar system, but somehow got as far as the Cardassian homeworld. A brief exchange with Gul Dukat reveals political undertones to the adventure. A success would mean accepting accomplishments of the ancient Bajorans that the Cardassians have dismissed as fairy tales. The trip proves an opportunity for Sisko and his son to talk. Jake reveals that he has been accepted as a fellow to the Pennington Institute, a prominent writing school in Wellington, New Zealand. Jake struggles with the idea of leaving Deep Space Nine, his father and his friends, but his deliberations during the voyage are cut short when the ship flies into a tachyon eddy, which accelerates the ship to warp speeds, but damages the vessel in the process. Sisko hadn't anticipated the effect because any modern spacecraft would have been too massive to be affected. Upon falling out of the eddy, Sisko charts the ship's position and is startled to find that the phenomenon has taken the sublight vessel far off course, and he is not at all certain of the location. As he and Jake consider their options, abandon the voyage and call for help from Deep Space Nine, or continue in a crippled vessel with little chance of ever finding anything, the ship is hailed by none other than Gul Dukat, who announces that they have reached Cardassian space, and thus proving that the idea that the ancient Bajorans could have done so long ago was possible. Furthermore, Dukat mentions their arrival coincides with the discovery of the remains of a similar solar vessel wrecked centuries ago on a Cardassian moon, just proving that the ancient voyage was made. Sisko remarks on the coincidence, intimating that the disclosure may have been a last-minute attempt on the part of the Cardassians to save face. As the travellers soak this information and celebrate, the Cardassians let off colourful photon charges, a form of fireworks to celebrate the achievement of Sisko and his son. A subplot involves Dr. Bashir discovering that the ship bearing his old academic rival from medical school is due to arrive. Competitive and nervous, Bashir is taken aback by her outright ignoring him at Quark's. After a bonding experience with Chief O'Brien, Bashir summons his courage and approaches the rival, who reveals the envied assignment she took, afforded to her by her superior class rank, turned out uninspiring. Meanwhile, she'd been following Bashir's work with great enthusiasm. Well...
But the I only had one real thought about this episode.
Go on. Lita?
And that was, no, Sisko's goatee.
That too.
What was the point of this one?
That's the problem.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, I kind of enjoyed this better. Like, I think I... A few weeks ago, I kind of let on that I wasn't real thrilled about this one. Not that I was overly thrilled about it, but I got more out of it this time, I think, than I perhaps when the first time I watched it. And I don't know. I'm not going to be as harsh as I think I thought I was going to be on this one.
See, I just went away from it. I was charmed by some of the individual scenes. I think the acting was great. I think there was some great writing in it. But ultimately, I got to the end of it and thought, well, so what? You know, the commander of the station can spend weeks building this Bajoran ship and then spend another couple of weeks just buggering off to see if he can prove that this journey ever happened. Nobody's going to miss the commander of Deep Space Nine.
It's another episode like that I think suffers for where it's placed in the continuity in a consecutive watching situation. Because we just got off an episode where things really ramped up with the Dominion, and the commander would not have the freedom to do this at this point. They would be desperately trying to figure out exactly what they're going to do and how they're going to deal with this threat. So I don't think it plays well as where it's placed. I think if you had placed it somewhere else, it would just seem a little bit more innocuous.
You know, he suddenly becomes the welding girl from, you know,
Rosie the Riveter?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's ultimately my whole point of this episode, is it's pointless.
It's A plot and B plot.
Yeah. And no, it's not that there weren't some individually good scenes. I love O'Brien and Bashir trying to fill the Garrick-shaped hole by having dinner with him, and O'Brien's a bloke, so he's just not interested, he's just there to have dinner. And the scene where they're drunk and singing Jerusalem, I mean, I wouldn't sing Jerusalem when I'm drunk, but whatever, it was charming scenes, and there was nice moments with Jake and Commander Sisko, and there's lots of nicely written character-based moments in an episode that otherwise doesn't do anything, and Gul Dukat's just wasted.
I think they just tried to, from the seriousness of, like they've done in the past, you have serious episode, some light episode, serious, light, and they tried to put in the light, and they could have done a light episode, but like you said, the whole thing with Sisko being obsessed with building a ship for a couple, what, at least 3 weeks? And then leaving the station?
At least several days, he said.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm surprised, though, that I'm kind of defending this more than I thought I was going to.
Well, purely from a logistic point of view, I think they'd be on a high alert security-wise with the whole thing that just went on with the Jem'Hadar.
Yeah.
I don't think they'd say, oh, you're going to go out with your little sailing ship? Go ahead, it's okay. Wait a minute. Aren't you the leader of this particular installation?
Takes me away to the Dinaris belt.
Yeah, it seemed to this mate Paul and I seem to have exactly the same problem with it. I just couldn't wrap my head around, after this serious threat has just happened on the other side of the wormhole, that Starfleet would be fine with Sisko taking this much time off from his duties. It just wouldn't happen. And it's the problem, the show hasn't quite got that serialized nature down just yet. Ira Stephen Burr only took over running the show with that two-parter, The Improbable Cause and The Die Is Cast. And I think, had he been in charge of the overall season, I don't think this episode would have happened here. It may have been a lighter, fluffier one earlier on, because you've got that nice big two-parter that you think is going to cruise us all down to the end of the season. And then what we have next, we've got another fluffy episode next. And then another Bajoran religious one after that. And it's only the final episode of the season where we pick up the Jem'Hadar plot. And it feels like it is the structure and layout of the episode, the structure of the season. Because they were still doing this as 46 minutes and done, they're not really planning out how to follow up these big events. And that hurts this one, in the sense that there's not really anything wrong with it. I just ended up watching it going, It doesn't pass the Spataro flick test. If I came across this one on TV, I may leave the scene on where Bashir and O'Brien are drunk, and then I'd change channel.
Oh, well, you got to leave the scene on where Leda comes up to...
Well, she's only at the very beginning. I mean, it is notable as an episode that Leta's introduction is very low-key, and she will go on to be quite important. And Sisko's beard makes its first appearance.
I think Sisko's beard is more of an introduction than Leda.
Yeah, because he does actually say, I just fancy to change. And so they actually introduce why he's got the goatee beard.
I don't know, Leda's got a really bad cough, though. Him!
It's, yeah.
Oh, wait, let me check that out.
Says Captain Smooth, Dr. Bashir.
And then Dax comes up, he types on the data pad, go away.
Yeah, when Jadzia cock blocks him at the beginning.
Yeah.
Now, all that said, other than the logistics of Sisko taking this trip and having the free time to do what he's doing, I thought it was overall a harmless episode, and it was not entirely unentertaining. It just didn't make sense where it came. I have a job that is not nearly as important as being the captain of this station, and I don't have the free time to do something like that. So I just don't see how he could do that. But just as a harmless fluff episode, it serves its purpose for that. Why it happens at all, I don't understand.
Well, it furthers Jake a little bit more as a character, showing he's going on a different path, and it was an interesting little discussion about how being homesick, and Sisko's story about how he, the first few nights when he went to the academy, he was transporting home, which I guess there's transporter credits here. I don't know, I thought they had no money. How does he have transporter credits? But anyway,
yeah, they're very inconsistent on finances at this point in their culture.
I think they're starting to get away from the Roddenberry, whole, oh, there is no money. We don't need money. It's a perfect society.
We've accepted
communism.
We just
do what we want.
Because that's really what he's saying, isn't it?
I like that O'Brien was the one at the beginning who said, why are we doing this? What's the point?
Yeah.
Because I kind of got the feeling that he was speaking for the audience.
Well, and it's an interesting thought about O'Brien, though, because you would think as an engineer he'd be into building things. On the other hand, this is a ship with no engine. So you can understand why he, you know, why he might eschew it. There's not a lot of depth here to talk about, unfortunately.
No, it's the Bashir plot we've kind of seen before. And I personally would have thought it would have been much more interesting if when she'd walked past him at the beginning, she wasn't ignoring him, she'd just forgotten him. Do you remember everyone you went to school with?
No.
No, okay. I just think that would have been a nicer touch, that she just didn't have any memory of him at all. I think that would have been much more interesting. And that's where I thought it was going to go at the beginning. And like I said, the Bashir O'Brien scenes have a certain charm to them, and Cole Meany plays the hell out of them as usual. But the rest of it just didn't do anything for me. I did like the Cardassian saving face at the end. Oh, look what we just happened to have found.
Oh, yes, yes.
That was good. But for the most part...
Although the fireworks made no sense to me at all.
No.
Right,
well, the solar wind thing didn't make any sense to me, but apparently that is genuine science.
Well,
although
we will be hearing shortly from Blaine.
We'll be hearing from Blaine.
For an episode we don't have much to say about, Blaine had a lot to say about it.
Well, that's good, because I presume he'll be more into the science of it. My understanding is the wings would have to be a lot larger, according to the Deep Space Nine companion.
Well, I remember, what was it, Star Trek IV to Voyage Home, remember the one ship that was disabled by the... by the whale probe.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you've got, you know, where you've got the Indian captain going, our engineers hoping to deploy a makeshift solar sail to gain a power to power life support. So
you sound,
and the ship's turning. And well, yeah, okay, yeah, right. Anyway, enough for that side tangent.
The only other thing I saw that was of interest to this particular episode was some people were getting the knickers in a bunch about the fact that an Irishman was singing Jerusalem.
Maybe you're more familiar with that song. See, I'm not familiar with that particular dirge.
My knowledge of Jerusalem is, I think it opens Songs of Praise. I think it's a song that they sing on Songs of Praise a lot. But it's not generally considered to be a hymn, because it doesn't praise God. It's just a general hymn about England, essentially. So it's entirely possible by the time we get to the 24th century, it's just a song that reminds them of home. Although it's also equally possible that if Northern Ireland is still Protestant and Catholic, that debate is still going on, it's possible that O'Brien's a Protestant rather than a Catholic Irishman, in which case it just makes perfect sense. But either way, you're still 400 years away from that song having any real political context. So it could just be that's the song that they both ended up singing when they were rat-arsed. And the truth of the matter comes from the fact that they were going to sing Louie Louie and couldn't afford the rights to it. So I didn't have a problem with him singing it. Cole Meany, obviously, I didn't have a problem with him singing it. And he's really Irish, so...
Very Irish.
Yeah. So, I mean, most people just seem to know it from Monty Python.
Yeah, I'm actually not really familiar with it. Anyways.
Is it sad that when I was reading the wiki, was it last night? I was more interested in the reference about Thorne Heyerdahl's Kon-Tiki expedition, and they ended up reading that. Talking about this was reminiscent of when he constructed. He was a Norwegian adventurer, and actually created
something or other.
Yeah, Thorne Heyerdahl.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'm mispronouncing.
Isn't that mentioned in the Disney? Isn't there a Disney thing about the Kon-Tiki? Or am I mixing up with the Tiki Tiki Room?
I don't know.
All right, fair enough.
Anyway, in 1947, he built a raft, a hand-built raft, and he sailed from South America to the Tuamotu Islands, and he was demonstrating that the ancient people could have made the long sea voyages. So this is kind of, I don't know if that's where they straight up got the idea, but I kind of got sucked into that whole thing and his life, and I'm like, wow, he was a really interesting guy. Oh, wait, we're talking about Deep Space Nine.
No, maybe the original story is interesting. I just didn't really think it applied to this show at this point.
Yeah. Oh, yes. It's, yeah. I mean, it was a little interesting to see the whole sailing stuff, and I guess they had the space sextant that got broken. They couldn't figure out where he was.
And the special effects were nice. And now it just seems like we're going out of our way to try and find nice things to say about it. Yeah.
But when you use a sextant, don't you have to... Well, I mean, I guess they could have... The whole point of a sextant when you were sailing, the way I remember it or understand it, is that you had fixed points in the sky, and that's how you could determine your location. Hmm. But you're in space. So, and they're traveling... I mean, they traveled so far... They traveled so far when they went to warp. How is that even going to be relevant? Like, I think a sextant works on Earth because you're in a smaller environment.
Yeah,
exactly. It won't change. When you're flying through space, that's going to change much more drastically, especially when you go to warp, and that's going to be useless unless you have charts for each location or each area that you're in.
Which the ancient Bajorans wouldn't have had once they hit warp.
Exactly. Yeah.
So they could have used the sextant to plot the initial stages of the journey, because from Bajor they could see the stars. But once they hit warp, they wouldn't have had a clue where they were going or what they were doing.
Right. Which they probably didn't plan on going to warp anyway, so... But I don't know, maybe Blaine covers some of that.
Maybe Blaine does, yes.
Blaine says, "Hi guys, you learn something new every day. Baraka is a Swahili word meaning good fortune, and not just some Mortal Kombat character that had a cameo playing Deadpool in X-Men Origins, Wolverine." Memory Alpha says, "The script included Ben giving the ship that name and explained why to Kira. I wonder why the popularity of Mortal Kombat at the time this aired had anything to do with its removal. We also get the first appearance of Ben Sisko's facial hair, and he gets to keep it. Sorry, LeVar." There are some great character moments between Ben and Jake, and Bashir's arrogance initially seems to be taken down a notch, although it's ultimately bolstered instead, both by O'Brien's amusing drunken confession and by Lenz's final reaction to him. Now, because I can't resist, a science lesson about solar winds, solar sails, and tachyons." Oops, that part of the email got all cut off. No, I'm kidding. Of course, Blaine, we will hear about solar winds to the tune of Baby Elephant Boy. "A burning sun gives off more than light and heat. In addition to those two forms of electromagnetic radiation, fusion reactions also release neutrinos, electrons, protons, and a number of other charged and uncharged particles. Without the Earth's magnetic field, cancer rates on the Earth's surface would be much higher because of this radiation."
Very good.
Bravo.
"The Earth's magnetic field also shuts off for a few days and changes direction every 20,000 years or so, which coincides with some mass extinction events in the fossil records. Don't worry, we're only about 2,000 years overdue for the next reversal. Penthouse apartments may become
less valuable
than basement suites if any budding Lex Luthers out there are planning their next real estate schemes. All of this radiation is pointed away from the star in question, and from far enough away, it's all basically parallel. Most importantly, for this decision, each and every one of those particles carries momentum. Solar sails are a viable, but still theoretical technology that takes advantage of that. A sufficiently large and properly made sail, with high albedo, the scientific term for shininess, can make use of this and sail on the cosmic wind much like a kite flying an atmospheric wing. No fuel is needed, so that makes the ship light and potentially cheap. I say potentially because creating materials that are strong enough to function this way, light enough to be easily accelerated by solar wind, and shiny enough to reflect light, electron, protons, and anything else in the solar wind to actually move are currently difficult and expensive to make. But that may change in the future, and they're still cheaper than a ship with enough fuel to reach another solar system. The question becomes, can they get you to warp speeds? No solar wind will propel a solar sail to warp speed. This is a fancy form of conventional thrust that will never push you past the speed of light. They can never push you past the speed of the particles propelling you, because if you outrun them, they stop hitting you and you stop accelerating. You can get arbitrarily close to light speed, though, since you are being propelled by light, which slows your personal perception of time down enough that you can survive a journey to almost anywhere. But time on your home world will not slow down, and many generations may pass before you return. Stopping and turning around are also problems. If you need to dodge an asteroid or rogue planet while en route, you may have no way to get your ship back on course. In other words, you may have nowhere else to go.
I got nowhere else to go! I got nowhere else to go! I got nothing else.
Rogue planet, see what he did there? Sorry.
Of course, the ship in this episode doesn't use solar wind to exceed the speed of light and go to warp. It uses a tachyon eddy. This sounds good enough since tachyons theoretically travel faster than light, so that's a different speed limit. The problem is that, as far as we can tell, tachyons don't exist. When Einstein first published the theory of relativity, people noticed that the math doesn't prevent you from having things above the speed of light, so long as they were traveling faster than light in the instant of their creation. These theoretical particles are tachyons. They would have imaginary mass, i.e., a tachyon's mass is the square root of a negative number, which are valid numbers, but which don't sound like it because they were named by mathematicians who don't want to accept such numbers and are mocked by their peers. You can work with these imaginary numbers if you want to, but I work with real numbers. Imaginary numbers are completely valid numbers. I've measured some in the lab. They just don't fit on the number line we're used to. As they gain energy, they get slower, approaching but never reaching the speed of light. They couldn't form molecules, as they would then be bound near each other, and applying relativity would mean that, from at least one point of view, they would be traveling at less than the speed of light, and that's never allowed. Most importantly, they are unable to interact with anything which is traveling at less than the speed of light, including a solar sail. The only interactions they are allowed to have are annihilation reactions, in which they are destroyed, but become other particles, which may only be photons and tachyons. If tachyons exist, we'd see traces of their existence in the photons spontaneously created by their annihilation, and we don't. We've been looking. If you've taken high school physics, you may recall, fondly or otherwise, solving problems like a football quarterback throws a football across the field. If the ball is 1.5 meters above the ground when it's released and is thrown at an angle of 45 degrees on the horizontal with an initial speed of 35 meters per second and the pass is incomplete, when does the ball hit the ground? Doing the algebra gives two answers, the correct 5.11 seconds and the incorrect negative 0.0599 seconds. The second is there because the curve we used represents the motion continues through all time. Had the football spent eternity following that curve, then it would have burst out of the ground at 0.0599 seconds prior to the quarterback letting it go, and would have spent a fraction of the second flying into the quarterback's hand. We disregard the solution as being clearly non-physical, and should treat tachyons with the same respect for the same reasons. And everybody who understood every bit of Blaine's logic there, I tip my hat to you.
I was with him until that last paragraph when he asked me to do real maths.
I was told it was
Sorry, I was I was doing a parody song. Looking for tachyons in all the wrong places. Looking for... Oh, sorry.
No, I found that quite interesting, because that was one of my questions about the episode, was, so how much is this is genuine science and how much of this is made up bullshit? And I don't have any problem with Star Trek making up shit, because, you know, it's science fiction. But the fact that there was some real science put into the thought of the solar winds was quite interesting. So, yeah, I was with him until that last paragraph.
See, and Bill,
then he made
me
do work.
I'm thinking, the solar winds came pouring from across Cardassia. They lingered there with Jake and Sisko. I can't think of anyone. I'm done. But, yeah, I mean, I'm kind of with you. What's funny is I kind of understood Blaine's logic reading through it until he got to the point saying, at high school physics, did you do this? And it's like, oh, I don't get it.
Yeah, the high school physics was the baffling bit to us. Everything else I was on board with.
But, I have to say, as much as we joke around about it, I really do appreciate Blaine giving us a kind of a scientific look at some of the science that... You know, Star Trek just throws out to you as science, in quotations. And I'm happy to see when he can tell us, even if the science is false, when he can give us some basis to say that it's well thought out. Which, in this respect, it sounds to me like, to some extent, it is.
Yeah, it sounds like they've given some thought to the whole solar winds thing, doesn't it?
It sounds to me, the way I take this is... It makes sense, exactly like you said, with the solar winds thing. And where it doesn't make sense, you could accept from a theoretical point of view, it's where our knowledge of science may fail. Now, Blaine is probably bristling at that thought.
No, that's not what I meant at all.
Now, in the time that, you know, that this show is theoretically taking place, our scientific knowledge will advance, and maybe we've come up with something else or some other explanation that kind of does jibe with what Blaine has told us, but just something we aren't aware of yet. And that's how I can accept it as being scientifically possible. But I like to just actually line it up with that. I prefer that much more to, this is absolutely impossible, it could never happen. I killed the room.
No, we entirely agree with you. So it's Andrew J. Robinson time again.
Yay!
No. Have we rated this episode?
I think we've rated it, yeah.
No, we haven't.
No, we didn't rate it at all.
I think my rating may shock you.
Shock me? Is that your BuzzFeed heading? Paul's rating for this episode will shock you.
Don't you know you wanna shock the monkey?
Dance, monkey, dance. You know, I saw this episode as, in a vacuum, watching it on its own, fairly entertaining, with a couple of nice character moments, especially between Jake and Sisko, between Jake and Ben, since they're both Sisko. The Dr. Bashir stuff, I think they could have just left that all out. It really did nothing for me. But if you accept the premise that he had the time to build this ship, and if you accept the premise that security-wise it would be acceptable for him to go out on this totally undefended ship at a time when there is a threat out there, if you accept those premises, I found it to be, you know, fairly entertaining and very watchable, although, as you said, Andy, I don't know that it survives the remote test. I'm going to just give it a 3. It's, you know, it's an average episode that was, you know, mildly entertaining, and I had no real problem with the episode itself other than a couple of the logistics and the fact that it really, you could just eliminate it from the show and it won't have any overall impact.
I find myself in agreement with you, and no, not just because I'm being agreeable.
Oh, very good.
I thought my initial rating of this once I remembered what episode this was, I was thinking, oh, this is going to be a 2 all day long, because I just remember this one just stinking up the room. So, but after I watched it and there was the beach between father and son and the fact that, you know, Jake's trying to set his dad up on a date, which was kind of funny. and which is also going to introduce the character of Cassidy Yates, I believe, towards the end of the season.
I want Cassidy Yates to come out and say, "Face it, Tiger, you hit the jackpot."
I'm going to give this a 3 as well. 3 broken solar sails will be my rating.
Well, I'm going to book the trend and just give it a 2. It's solidly average for me. There's a couple of good scenes, a couple of good acting moments, but as an overall episode, I just didn't care. I'll be honest with you. I didn't want to fast forward it, and it didn't bore me while I was watching it. So that's a good thing. But when I got to the end of it, my overall impression was, so what? So, 2.
So the only reason you kept watching was to see if Lita would come back.
Yeah. I met Lita in person. Leave me alone.
Shut up, you.
Okay. Shutting up now. Shutting up, sir.
Yeah, so I bet she'll be it at...
I guess we could move on to our friend Andrew J. Robinson. Do I get to read some more?
Do you want to read, or I could try to read?
Do you want me to do it if you're not up to it?
You haven't read much at all, so if you feel up to it, that's fine. If you don't feel up to it, I will gladly take it for you.
No, I'll do it, because you just did all of Blaine's email. So go on, Bill. It's your call.
Okay, I'll give it a go.
Alright.
Alrighty. Chapter 2. Entry. When I was at the age of emergence, I was sent to the Bamaran Institute for State Intelligence to begin my education as a secret operative. This kind of education is usually reserved for children of the current ruling elite, but sometimes a child from the service ranks is identified as promising. I was one of those children. My father was a maintenance foreman in charge of the grounds, monuments, and memorials of the Tarlac sector, a majestic and ghostly place that commemorates the heroes of the Cardassian state. My mother was housekeeper to an Auburn Tane, the man who owned the house we lived in, who worked at the Obsidian Order, the mysterious agency responsible for state security. We lived in the basement apartment of Uncle Inabrin's house, and my parents proudly identified themselves as servants of Cardassian public ritual and cleanliness. It was always assumed that I would become apprentice to my father. Many of my earliest memories are of preparing for and cleaning up after state funerals and dedication ceremonies. I was a serious little boy, studiously carrying out my duties and responsibilities. I had to. Father was much older than mother, and he never said much, but what he did say was always clear and to the point. Anyone who worked for him understood that if he had to repeat himself, you would very quickly be demoted to maintaining the city's sewers. Mother not only maintained Tane's house, but also worked with him at the Obsidian Order. He was particular about who cooked and cleaned for him, and depended upon Mother for all his personal needs. I was never sure what it was he did. I just assumed he was important enough to afford a house and a servant. The Obsidian Order was housed in those days underneath the assembly building, and it was years before I even knew where the entrance was. As a child, I would go to the Tarlac sector with Father, and while he supervised his crews, I'd play by myself amid the black and white angularity of the monuments, imagining myself a great gull or legate giving the funeral oration for a fallen comrade. There was nothing about the Obsidian Order that inspired or excited my childish fantasies, nothing but silence and mystery. But Tane at home was anything but mysterious. It was not unusual for Uncle Nalbrin to appear and take me away on some excursion that involved a long walk through a section of the city. During these walks, he tested my awareness and challenged me to describe a house or person we'd just passed. If I hadn't been paying attention and couldn't remember the details, the walk was over and we'd silently return home under the oppressive weight of his disapproval. He also seemed to know how I was performing at school, and if he wasn't satisfied with my progress or behavior, he'd... Let me start that over. He also seemed to know how I was performing at school, and if he wasn't satisfied with my progress or behavior, he'd punish me. I was a hard worker, but I had a mischievous streak, and I enjoyed getting others involved in questionable activities and arranging it so they were found out and took the blame. On those rare occasions when I was caught, Tane would somehow find out and punish me, not for my misdeed, but for having been caught. And after he discovered my fear of small, dark spaces, his favorite punishment became keeping me in one until I had convinced him that I had analyzed and fully understood how my mischievous scheme had gone wrong. I found it odd that mother and father never had anything to say about these punishments. One day, shortly after the emergence ceremony at school, where I was acknowledged as a man, I came home ready to assist father at the dedication of the Baltar War Memorial. I was surprised to find my parents at home with a stranger. They were never at home at this time of day, and we rarely entertained guests. They were very private people, and even discouraged me from bringing any of my schoolmates home. Both were clearly ill at ease with this man, with whom they introduced to me as an official from Institute Placement. At first I thought I was in trouble, and my face must have reflected this fear, because father attempted to reassure me with a forced smile. But the uncharacteristic falsity of his behavior and his barely concealed agitation only made the situation worse. I had never seen him like this. Mother's face was a mask. It revealed nothing. She spoke as if I needed to clean off the day's work before we ate. Elam, it seems you have a sponsor. You are going to be placed at a prestigious institute. You leave today. And just like that, any kind of response was beyond me. I had no idea what this meant. I stood there, looking at the three of them, looking at me, and expecting some kind of reaction on my part. The Barmarian Institute, father added, as if this was the vital and missing piece that would enlighten me. Oh, I knew about the institutes. What student didn't? I knew that each student needed a sponsor, someone high up in the government or military who would recommend the student and guarantee his or her performance. And I knew that I had reached the age when students were moved on to their next education level, the level that would determine their working lives. But those schoolmates of mine who had been identified and assigned to an institute had known well in advance that they were going and who the sponsor was. When I began to ask who mine was, father cut me off. That is none of your business, Elam. Your business is to get cleaned up and ready to go. His business is to serve Cardassia and the Empire in thought, word, and deed, intoned the official. Your childhood is over, Elam Garrick. I was stunned. I wanted to ask more. I wanted to ask about the dedication ceremony that afternoon, but I didn't care. Father had that look when one of the workers didn't get it right the first time. But what had I done wrong? Mother, as if reading my mind, suddenly turned to me. This is a great honor, Elam, she said with a passion that startled me and belayed her mask. I felt that it was anything but. It was a long time before I learned the truth about my sponsor. And that ends chapter 2, where we have learned that Elam was picked for the path that he would go down in his life.
Yeah.
And
is the implication here that Enna Bryn Tane is his dad?
That's
so.
What I'm getting from it, too.
I think that's always been the implication. I think that was the implication on the series.
Right.
And I think what they're giving us, or what Andrew Robinson is giving us, kind of plays hand-in-hand with his performance of Garrick. That this isn't something he would seek out for himself, because he was somewhat more, for lack of a better word, sensitive or thoughtful in how he did things. He isn't just a mindless assassin out there. He really is somebody who takes in the whole situation and really analyzes it and goes through everything. And I think he just isn't your typical assassin, and that's probably why he, in his own way, excelled at it. because he had a greater skill set or a greater ability to, you know, to kind of assess situations. He wasn't just a mindless drone out there. Does that make any sense at all? I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I think he does seem to be a little bit more thoughtful and open to a thing here than other Cardassians. But the thing with the Cardassians is they do tend to fall into that Klingon stereotype. What do Klingons do with people that aren't warriors? There must be Klingon librarians and Klingon latrine cleaners. So the Cardassians must have them as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's Garrick's mother.
Yeah. So, yeah, he was clearly just on that path. And the only reason I can think for keeping his parentage a secret is that Ena Bryn Tane has many enemies.
Enemies, yeah. Yeah, because the line in this chapter that says that she saw to his personal needs is kind of, you know, hinting at that.
And it's just, you know, as we said, it makes me want to read more and read on.
Yeah, you just want to carry on with
the next chapter in our next episode. Next one is short also, so we probably will do a read through on that as well.
Yeah, it's shorter than the one than this last chapter. And it's going to jump back and forth between a few things, and then once we get to 6, I think it stays in his past.
Yeah, I think 6 is the first chapter that's probably too long to read.
Yeah.
So, we'll, you know, that one we'll have to just summarize, but I think 3, 4, and 5 we can probably read on the show. Well, what are we doing besides reading the next chapter? What are we doing next time?
Next time on an all-new episode of Listen to the Prophet, it's another Quark episode. Family business.
If a Ferengi woman earns profit...
It's the end of Ferengi civilization as we know it.
Someone must pay.
We're in trouble.
When it's Quark's own dear mother...
I'm ruined.
There's only one solution.
I will wring that confession out of her. I'm not confessing anything.
Mother's Day could get messy. On the next episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
That looks like quite a good one.
Dun, dun.
Yeah, I think we get, what's his name? An introduction, a new character.
Brunt.
Brunt, yeah.
Jeffrey Combs returning.
Yeah. Is this the third or fourth alien he plays on Star Trek?
I don't know. He's played so many.
A tremendous number of them. I don't know in what order they appeared, though, so I have no idea which, where this falls in that.
Okay. Well, that's next time.
Private Eye. Ba-dum-bum.
See you all next time.
Goodbye.
Bye. Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast, is a Two True Freaks presentation. It is hosted by Andrew Leyland and Paul Spataro. The music and sound clips used in the show are copyright CBS and Paramount Entertainment. If you like to buy stuff from Amazon, and who doesn't, why not drop by the twotruefreaks.com website, where if you click the little link that we have there, it will take you straight through that site, and whilst it won't cost you any extra, we'll put a few shekels in our tip jar, which helps create content like this. We very much hope you enjoyed listening to The Prophets. Every episode is dedicated to the memory of our pal, Sean Engel.
Curse you, Leyland!
Sorry.